The following presentation was recorded live by Voices from Jerusalem.
Children's. The one problem that comes up more than any other one in my workshops. What is it about our children's fighting that so bothers us? Well, we want our children to love each other, to be kind to each other. Hine matov umanoim sheva sachim gam yachad. How good and pleasant it is when brothers dwell together in harmony. Shalom, peace, that's what we all want. We mention it in all our prayers. It's one of the names of Hashem. And in Hebrew, it's the word we use both for greeting and taking leave of each other. Shalom. So we want peace. But what do we have? War! And in our own homes. Our dear sweet children are fighting with each other. Why? Why do children fight? And it's in every house, isn't it? Otherwise, it wouldn't be the favorite topic in my workshops. I ask the women, what subject would you like to discuss today? And what do they all want to talk about? Their children's fighting. So, the most commonly given explanation for why children fight is to get attention. Now, I find that hard to accept. True, children will often try, after a fight's gotten started, to draw us into the conflict, for reasons which we'll soon discuss. But that's not their motive for fighting. Because if it were, then we would expect to see that when their parents are out of the house, the children don't fight. Now that's not true, is it? We know very well that kids fight even when the parents aren't at home. Sure, ask any babysitter. So what's the explanation? It's simple. Children fight because they're being intolerant of each other and they're using aggressive methods to settle their differences. So, our kids are fighting. And what do we do? Well, one of the things we do is try to settle the fight for them by playing judge, conducting lengthy investigations to find out who the guilty party is. All right, 7-year-old Yankee and 6-year-old Rivki are playing in their room. We're in the kitchen. Suddenly we hear a scream, then a shout, accompanied by sounds of scuffling. Another fight is underway, and now we come running in. What happened, we ask. He started, says Rivki. I didn't ask who started. I want to know what happened. She hit me, says Yankee. Why did you hit him? He took my toy away. Why did you take it? I wanted to play with it. It's not only hers. She had it long enough. Why couldn't you give him a turn? Didn't you think you had it long enough? No, I just had it for a few minutes. She only had it for a few minutes. Why did you have to take it away? And so it goes on until finally in the end we pronounce judgment. Turning to the one, we say, you shouldn't have grabbed her toy. You should have found something else to do. And turning to the other, it wasn't very nice of you. You should have given him a chance to play with the toy. And you don't have to hit either if all he wanted was a turn. Now, what's accomplished by all this? First of all, this approach greatly encourages the children to involve their parents in their fights, with each child trying to get the parent to side with him. But something else. each of the children wants us to declare him the innocent party and put the blame on the other one. So now, while you're scolding the one party, the other is glorying in his innocence, secretly happy to see the other one getting it, and vice versa. Not the most charitable of feelings. Let's go further. A child who sees himself as an innocent victim is bound to be feeling resentful about getting a scolding. And who will he be blaming for that? The other one, of course. And so, in the end, the children end up mad at each other, mad at you too, and all we've done is set the scene for the next battle. Older children frequently end up getting it. You're the older one. You should know better. Or, we'll deliver a lengthy lecture on the subject of brotherly love. You children should love each other and not fight. But such words are usually wasted. Children who fight are angry at each other and in no mood for lectures. But there are times when we decide that we simply can't take it anymore. That's it. Enough. All day long, nothing but fighting. And over what? Nonsense. And now we go in and really let our children have it. I can't stand another minute of this dreadful fighting. Stop it now, do you hear? And how many of us haven't ended up spanking both children, angrily yelling, I don't care who started, you're both getting it. Well, this may make us feel better for the moment, but it's hardly the way to encourage the peaceful resolution of conflict which we'd like our children to learn. Okay, so what do we do? If we want to handle the problem effectively, we have to resolve first not to become aggravated over the fighting or let it make us angry. As fervently as we may want peace, we had better accept the fact that for the time being at least, there's going to be fighting. An unfortunate reality, certainly unpleasant, but not horrible or unbearable. And we have to avoid blaming or judging our children, even if only to ourselves. We have to think in terms of how to best influence our children to get along better with each other. This calls for an objective and non-judgmental attitude. We should also avoid blaming ourselves for our children's fighting. So many of us have this idea that if our children fight a lot, it's got to be our fault. We must be doing something wrong. After all, it's our job as parents to see to it that our children behave properly. And if they're fighting, obviously we're failing at our job. But this is kind of ridiculous, isn't it? Squabbling and quarreling between children is so normal that there practically is no family that is free of it. I've told you that the one subject which comes up more than any other in my workshops is children's fighting. You're not going to tell me that all these women are failing at their job. Okay, so we stop seeing ourselves as personally responsible for our children's fights, and we no longer view each of their conflicts as if we should have prevented it. And now we'll find ourselves much better able to stay calm enough to handle the problem effectively. Difficult as this may be, we have to learn to refrain as far as possible from interfering to settle our children's fights. True, it is our responsibility to teach our children not to fight, but this can't be accomplished by our intervening while any fighting is going on. We have to find another time for working out with the children the ways and means of settling their difficulties peacefully. I know what you're going to ask. Might not one child take unfair advantage of another child when we remove ourselves in this way? Yes, that might happen. But can we hope to supervise matters in such a way so as to make everything always completely fair? It's impossible, isn't it? So we might as well give up the effort. Besides, we should keep in mind that children are bound sooner or later to be exposed to others who will not always be so kind to them. They might as well get used to some rough treatment and learn to tolerate it. All right, so if we have until now tried to settle our children's fights for them, we should explain to them that we will no longer interfere because we want them to learn to resolve their own conflicts. So now, when we hear the usual agitated voices, we resist the urge to run in to see what happened and instead calmly go about our business as usual. We know, don't we, how often those ear-piercing screams are often nothing more than acts which the child puts on for our benefit just to get us to come running and at the same time to powerfully impress us with how horribly he's being treated so as to get our protection as the victim. Of course, you have to use your judgment, but you can usually tell if there's anything really serious going on which requires your intervention. You never let your children really hurt each other. Okay, so you don't go in and you ignore the fighting. But suppose they now come in and start trying to involve you. So you tell them, "I'm really sorry that you're fighting. See if you can find a peaceful way to settle it by yourselves." Or you can say, "I have confidence that you can settle this quietly." Firmly resist all their efforts to get you involved. Try, though, to avoid saying things like this: "I'm not getting into this. You kids have to settle it by yourselves." Because that sounds uncaring. There's one problem with this. Some children get really upset when you refuse to do anything to help them. Here your daughter comes to tell you that her brother just hit her, and all she gets is this speech: "I'm sure you children can settle this peacefully." She's not going to be so happy. She may even say, "You don't even care." Of course we care, but for this child, caring means doing something to help her. In such situations, you assure the offended party that you will talk to the offender about it later. You can say something like this: "I do care, but right now it's better that you try to settle matters between yourselves. I'll talk to your brother about this later." Now, you'll find that even though there may not be any sudden dramatic decrease in the incidence of fighting, you will feel a great sense of relief because now you no longer feel responsible for resolving all your children's conflicts. You may, however, be surprised to find that your children actually begin to settle conflicts by themselves once you're out of the picture. Two mothers wrote down for me their stories, telling about their experiences. Here's the first story. Benny is a child with low frustration tolerance. He doesn't often fight with his siblings, but when he does and I intervene, he usually walks off in a huff. He never apologizes and would rather be confined to his bed — goes there by himself, I never send him there — than apologize. In general, he has a way of blaming everything on someone else. For example, if he falls, he will immediately say, "Davy tripped me," although Davy is nowhere in sight. On this particular day, Benny began fighting with his sister and pushed her against the wall. She began screaming, a bit for sympathy, as she was not really hurt. I did not interfere this time. She kept on crying. I watched the clock. 4 long minutes passed. Then I heard the most remarkable statement from Benny. With actual sincerity, he bent over his sister and softly said, I'm sorry, Esty. Score 1 for not interfering. Here's the second story. I told my 2 sons they could help themselves to packaged drinks which I had bought for them. The younger boy took his first, an orange flavor, leaving a lemon flavor drink for the older brother. He wanted his younger brother's orange flavor drink and came to me to complain and ask for my intervention. I told him that I was sure they could settle it by themselves. Expecting the older one to grab the drink out of the younger one's hands, I braced for screams. Quiet. A few minutes later, the older one came in, treasure in hand. Oh, you have it, I said. What happened? I just asked him. He gave it to me. Mothers also tell me that fights tend to resolve themselves more quickly when they stay out. But best of all, they say, they don't end up feeling so worn out. Let me read to you what one mother wrote. When I manage to keep myself from interfering in the children's fights, I find that, although there may not be less fights, still, the fights blow over more quickly. But most importantly, I have not become involved, upset, angry, and so on. I am not worn out, as I tend to be when I do step in, and then matters just go on and on. For those of you who see your children's fighting as a never-ending affair, let me suggest that you try the following experiment. Keep track for 1 day of the actual number and duration of fights. You may be surprised to find that total fighting time is far below what you had supposed. Now, even though I'm strongly recommending that you allow your children to work out their differences by themselves, this doesn't have to become a hard and fast rule. You have to use your judgment. You always separate the children, of course, if the fighting is getting rough and it looks like someone could really get hurt. In this case, you say to them, I cannot let you hurt each other like this. I must separate you. And then you put each child in a separate room for a cooling off period. I don't particularly like locking children into rooms, but if you have to do that to prevent someone from getting hurt, you do it. After all, you're responsible for their welfare. Some parents feel that since it's wrong to hit another person, children must never be permitted to do it. If you feel that way, then you separate your children whenever they hit. One mother told me about her way of handling hitting. Any child who hits gets punished by having to sit on a chair in the middle of the room. Any room, just not their bedroom. 5 minutes for hitting, 10 minutes for kicking or biting. Of course, this is suitable only for younger children, about up to age 8, I would say. All right. Fights between very young children generally involve disputes over toys. Nothing too serious. When things get too rough, you can separate them. Don't get involved in their dispute. Just say, okay, kids, I think you'd better play separately for a while. If one of the children is crying, you talk to him soothingly. Yes, I know. You're so unhappy. Now, don't force your children to share. You can encourage them to share, by suggesting it to them. It's nice to share our things with others, and then praising them when they do it. How nice the way you're sharing your new truck. If a child is monopolizing some toy, you can suggest, "Why don't you give him a turn? I'm sure he'd like one." As the children become older, we can begin to have individual talks with them on the subject of fighting, after tempers have calmed down and they are ready to listen. In addition to helping them work out more peaceful solutions to differences, we need to also remind children from time to time about the Torah commandments and prohibitions which relate to fighting. Forbidden actions include hitting, causing pain with words or actions, lashon hara, derogatory speech, and holding a grudge or seeking revenge. They should be reminded also about the Torah obligation to judge others charitably, and very important, that in order to receive forgiveness when we've offended someone else, we must first ask the person for forgiveness. Talks with more than one child can sometimes work out very well. Let me present to you how you might handle it with the following typical problem, which was presented to me recently by one mother. Her two sons, ages 8 and 11, would always get into fights when they were together for a long period of time, such as over the weekend. The older boy tended to bully his younger brother. The younger boy would then get very upset and go to his bed and cry himself to sleep. Their last fight had started with the older boy yelling at his brother for messing up his books. The younger boy then called him a name, whereupon his older brother began kicking him. The younger boy then tried to fight back, unsuccessfully, until the older brother gave him a really strong kick, which sent the younger one to his room, crying. Here is how I suggested she handle it. Tell the boys, at a time when they are both calm and in a good mood, that you want to talk to them. Settle yourselves comfortably somewhere, and then tell them as follows. Boys, your fighting is very unpleasant for all of us. Let's talk about it now and see whether we can find ways to settle disagreements more peacefully. But let's agree that in this discussion, you don't talk about how it's the other one's fault and what he should be doing, but that each one of you talks only about himself and what he could do to avoid the fights. Okay, said the mother, but each one's going to insist that it's all the other one's fault and that he never does anything wrong. All right, I said to her, then you say this. Boys, it always takes two to have a fight. For instance, in your last fight, if you hadn't called your brother a name after he yelled at you for messing up his books, there wouldn't have been a fight, right? Okay, so let's take this fight and see what each one of you could have done so that it could have been prevented. Let's start from the beginning. Now you turn to the older boy and say to him, what would have happened if you had talked to him quietly about the books? Like if you'd said, you know, you messed up my books. There wouldn't have been any fight, would there? Because then your brother wouldn't have felt bad and he wouldn't have called you a name. Now you turn to the younger boy and say to him, okay, your brother yelled at you, but suppose that you wouldn't have called him a name, but would have just asked him to please not yell at you. You see, then he wouldn't have hit you. And again, no fight. Now you turn again to the older one and say to him, all right, so your brother called you a name. But what if instead of kicking him, you had said to him, without yelling, don't call me names, I don't like it. You see how it works? At each stage, there's always some way to stop the fight. You can also teach your children greater tolerance. For instance, a child comes to complain, it's not fair, I had the ball and he just grabbed it away from me. You can first tell him, I'm so sorry. But then go on and say, honey, maybe if you didn't insist that everything has to be fair, you wouldn't feel so bad. You see, whenever we say, this isn't fair, we get ourselves upset. It's much better for us if we can simply learn to accept it. Try to remember to be empathetic. This is especially helpful to the children when they're upset and angry. One mother told me how this worked with her 8-year-old son. The boy, who had just cleaned up his room and was very pleased with its appearance, became suddenly explosively angry because his sister, with whom he shared the room, left a few of her toys lying around. She waited till he'd calmed down a bit, and then came in and said, very quietly, "I understand that the mess bothers you a lot, but if you could just say to your sister, 'I don't like it when you make a mess,' you would feel so much better." He listened, and afterwards she saw that he was in an especially good mood and wanting very much to please her. All right, teasing, the cause for so many fights. Here are some ideas for handling it. A child who teases should be quietly told that he's not allowed to do this if it makes others feel bad. We can influence children to stop teasing by getting them to put themselves in the other person's position. For instance, a younger child constantly teases her older sister for thumb-sucking. We can tell the child quietly, "You're teasing her about her thumb-sucking. Now tell me, you wet your bed or are overweight. How would you feel if she teased you about that? You'd feel bad, wouldn't you? And so does your sister when you tease her about thumb-sucking." There are children who will come crying to us because they were hit by a sibling when the hitting was provoked in the first place by teasing. Here we might initially empathize with the child. Later we can call him aside, saying gently, "You came to me before crying because your sister hit you. But you know, I heard you teasing her before. Maybe that's why she hit you. I guess she didn't like it. So if you don't want to get hit by her again, maybe it would be better not to tease her anymore." Sometimes it helps if we show a child how his excited reactions to being teased merely provide entertainment. We might say, "Do you know why he's teasing you? Because he likes to see you jump up and down and scream. He thinks it's funny. He enjoys it. Are you going to give him that enjoyment? How about the next time he teases you, thinking to yourself, 'I'm not going to give him a good time. I'm just not going to react. I'll just ignore him.'" Another way of influencing the child is with the following approach, which was suggested by one mother who found it to be very successful. Here's her story. "My 9-year-old Sammy would get very angry when teased by his younger brother of 6, Itzik. One day I said to him, 'You know, you've made yourself into a puppet, and you gave Itzik the strings. Every time you get mad when Itzik teases you, you're giving him the strings.' I told him that this conversation would be a secret between him and me, and that his brother wouldn't have to know about it. Then I said, 'I'm going to help you get the strings back for yourself, but I know it'll be hard for you to remember. Let's decide on a code word. Whenever you get mad because Itzik is teasing you, I'll say strings.' Besides helping him gain control, I think he appreciated the mutuality between us, the idea of a special relationship. I had to use the code word several times during the next few weeks. After that, very little. It really helped." Another mother found that humor works best for her. Once, one of her children was particularly upset over being teased. She ran over, exclaiming with exaggerated anxiety, "Where's the bleeding? Show me quick! Let's get the bandages! Shall I call an ambulance?" The child, greatly amused, quieted down right away. After she did this a few times, he pretty well caught on that being teased wasn't so bad after all, and that he could survive it. And now for a final word. If your children fight a lot, you may sometimes find yourself thinking, when will they ever learn to get along? When you're feeling discouraged that way, think back to when you were a child and remember the fights in your home. But then you all grew up, and one day you discovered that you were too old to fight. Think of that, and it will help you to feel more optimistic. We're going to talk about empathy. It's something we all want, don't we? For others to put themselves in our position and let us know that they understand. It's a form of chesed, loving kindness, an obligation we all have toward each other, to extend ourselves to improve other people's happiness. But if we're not in the habit of being empathetic, we have to cultivate it. A good way to do this is to keep in mind how dissatisfying an unempathetic response can be when we want some understanding from another person. So often we have some problem, and all we really want is for the other person to listen to us, to understand our feelings. Instead, they start telling us what we should do, how we should feel. They mean well, but it leaves us feeling ununderstood. It's the same with our children. When they come to us with their problems, we should ask ourselves, how would I want someone else to respond to me if I were in the child's position? Sometimes it's just a question of a word or two of empathy, curbing that initial impulse to tell the child what to do and letting him know first that we understand his feelings. The results are sometimes nothing short of miraculous. I have two favorite stories which beautifully illustrate this. The first was told to me by a mother who came in unable to contain her excitement over what had happened 2 days before. Our discussion at the previous meeting had been on empathy, and this incident happened the very next morning. First, she told us about her 9-year-old Ephraim, who, though ordinarily a gentle and well-behaved child, had an occasional stubborn streak which she had never been able to get around. When he set his mind to something contrary to what she wanted, she would find herself forcing the issue angrily, resulting in an unhappy, sulking boy and a frustrated mommy. On this particular morning, Ephraim was feeling out of sorts because of fever blisters on his tongue. Enough to make a child miserable, but not enough reason to stay home from school. When she went in to rouse him, Ephraim grumbled. 3/4 of an hour later, she realized amid her activity with the other children that Ephraim was still in bed. Formerly, she would have stormed into Ephraim's room to demand that he get dressed immediately, resulting in resentful compliance. This time, she was armed with our previous evening's workshop discussion on empathy. Rehearsing mentally, she entered the room. Ephraim was still beneath his quilts. Ephraim, she said gently, I know you're not feeling well this morning, but get dressed anyway. Having said that, she bit her tongue and left. 3 minutes later, she curiously peeked into the room. To her utter amazement, Ephraim was up and entirely dressed down to his shoes. And all this without a frown. She could not help reviewing and reviewing the scene excitedly all day in her mind, trying to figure out what had happened. The second story is from a Montreal mother. She had an ongoing problem with her 11-year-old son, who didn't want to go to his Pirche group on Shabbos afternoon. Then he would complain endlessly that he had nothing to do. At that point, they would get into a 15-minute argument. She would say he has to go. He would answer that they never do anything there anyway. She would try to convince him that he'd have a good time, and so it would go on. In the end, he would go out the door, with both of them feeling bad. On this particular Shabbos, he came to her saying, as usual, "I don't want to go today." She turned to him and said, "Jonathan, I know you don't like to go to the Pirche, but it's so much better for you to go than to stay here and be bored." He got up and walked out of the room. She was sure he was just going to read in his room, but in a minute she heard the front door open. He walked out and went to Pirche. Unbelievable, but true. Empathy sometimes consists of no more than lending a sympathetic ear as the child gets some problem off his chest. Just listening with an occasional, or yes, or I know. That's enough to help the child clarify his thinking. Some simple reflecting back can help in facilitating the unloading process. So, for example, if your child is telling you about his friend who's been ignoring him lately, you might say, "You're worried that he doesn't want to be your friend anymore." Becoming more empathetic consists also of avoiding certain things. One of these is not to discount or contradict your child's perceptions. If he says he's still thirsty after 3 glasses of juice, don't say, "But you just drank 3 whole glasses. It's much better to tell him, "You're still thirsty." That doesn't necessarily mean that you give him another drink. If you think he shouldn't have any more, you can tell him, "I think you've had enough for now. Later you can have more." Don't be in a rush to get your children over their unhappy feelings. You don't like it if someone tells you when you're feeling low, "Never mind, you'll get over it." So let's not do it to our children. Many people think this is encouraging, but it isn't. Far more helpful when someone is feeling down is to say, "I know, it's rough." Let me give you an example. Your daughter comes home upset because of a poor grade on an exam, after she had stayed up many nights to prepare herself. Don't tell her, "Come on, don't be so upset. You'll do better next time." Tell her instead, "How disappointing to study so hard and then get a low mark anyway." With a little empathy and understanding, children usually get over their unhappy feelings by themselves. We can, however, go beyond this and teach children the same cognitive principles which we discussed in my first tape on handling our emotions. When they are calm and in a receptive mood, we can show children how they largely bring on their own unhappiness by their particular way of viewing events in their lives. We can explain that we all have the choice to make ourselves either happy or unhappy, depending on what we think or tell ourselves about the things which happen to us. Here's an example I like to give. Life is like a big store. There are 2 counters in this store, one on the right and one on the left. The counter on the right has a big sign over it, which says, "Happiness." That's where we buy thoughts which make us feel good. Over the counter on the left side is a sign which says "unhappiness." That's where we buy thoughts which make us feel bad. We have a choice. We can decide which counter we will buy at. We can decide what we will think and how we will feel. After giving this example, we can ask the child what kinds of thoughts are bought at the unhappiness counter and then go on to help him identify his own upsetting thoughts. If he has difficulty, we can suggest some likely possibilities. We can ask, "Were you by any chance telling yourself this and this?" At an evening meeting some time ago, a friend came over to tell me about the nice results she had gotten by using this example with her 8-year-old daughter. The girl had the tendency to be in an unhappy mood without realizing that she was doing it to herself. My friend had just read my chapter on empathy and decided to explain the example to her daughter, who at the time was in a good mood. She started by saying, "Let's play a game that we go into a store," and then presented the rest, ending up with telling her, "It's your choice. You come out of the store with what you bought. You can decide if you want to be happy or sad by using your own thinking." It was lunchtime, and my friend's 5-year-old son was sitting at the table eating, but she focused her attention only on the daughter. The discussion ended with the girl not seeming to accept the idea too happily. The next day, her daughter came home in a very unhappy mood, complaining about something that had happened in school. The 5-year-old was again at the table eating lunch. My friend turned to her daughter and said, "I want you to think a moment. What counter were you buying at now?" Whereupon her son suddenly jumped up and said, I know what counter." The daughter responded, "I don't care, I don't want to play that game." But within 2 minutes, her mood had changed, and she was happily eating. Now, when her daughter is unhappy, stamping her feet or yelling, my friend just gives a small reminder about the counters, and her daughter catches herself and stops in a few minutes. It helps her to accept frustration more happily. Now, as valuable as empathy may be, there are situations where it is not appropriate. I'll never forget the story of the 15-year-old boy who was very discouraged because he was worried about an injury to his ankle becoming permanent. The mother tried being empathetic, reflecting back the boy's feelings. She said, "I know. You're really worried that your ankle is never going to get better." Surprisingly, he became very agitated, saying, "I don't want to hear that. I want you to assure me that it's nothing serious." We need to sense what's appropriate in each situation. Okay, now something else. Empathy is valuable. There's no doubt about that. But some people have confused empathy with acceptance. And this is a mistake. Acceptance means that we like another person the way he is. This is a Torah obligation. But the fact that we disapprove of a child's behavior does not mean that we reject him for it. The people who confuse empathy with acceptance say that we must accept all of a child's feelings in order that he feel that we accept him. They don't realize that we can be empathetic and even very loving at the same time that we correct the child for his wrong behavior. Let's not forget also, though, that the Torah does not permit us to accept all a child's feelings. We have to keep in mind that those who recommend the idea of total acceptance of a child's feelings do not have absolute Torah values to impart to their children. Now, Lashon Hara, derogatory speech, is a serious Torah prohibition. And so, if your child tells you some bad things about a classmate, you do not show acceptance by reflecting back his feeling. We can show him empathy, though, by speaking to him in a quiet and caring way. So we can say to him, "I know you're angry at your friend, but you're not allowed to tell me any bad things about other people." Angry feelings should never be reflected back. This is because anger is a bad character trait, and we don't want to encourage his expressing it. I know this goes contrary to what many of you have been told, that suppressing anger is harmful, and that we should encourage children to let their anger out. How wrong this advice is was brought home to me recently by the experiences of one father. His youngster of 4 got angry rather frequently, and he had been following the advice of reflecting back a child's angry feelings. But it didn't seem to help. In fact, it just seemed to make things worse. Then one day, when the child was exceptionally frustrated, he said, "I'm so mad, I want to break the whole house." At this point, the father realized that the situation had gotten out of hand. Since then, he stopped reflecting back anger and is now trying to teach his son to control himself. Remember, too, that the ventilationist approach has lately been challenged by several psychologists who say that giving vent to anger usually intensifies it. Dr. Carol Tavris, in her book, Anger, the Misunderstood Emotion, writes that talking out an emotion doesn't reduce it, it rehearses it. She says as follows, "Expressing anger makes you angrier. As you recite your grievances, your emotional arousal builds up again, making you feel as angry as you did when the infuriating event first happened. And in addition, establishing an attitude about the source of your rage." She concludes by bringing some very interesting results of an experiment which was made with a group of third graders. I quote, "The children were frustrated and irritated by another child whom the experimenters had enlisted in their cause. They were then given one of three ways of handling their anger. Some were permitted to talk it out with the adult experimenters. Some were allowed to play with guns for cathartic release or to get even with the frustrating child. And some were given a reasonable explanation from the adults for the child's annoying behavior. What reduced the children's anger? Not talking about it. Not playing with guns. That made them more hostile and aggressive as well. The most successful way of dispelling their anger was to understand why their classmate had behaved as she did. She was sleepy, upset, not feeling well." How reassuring to us to see that psychologists are now beginning to recognize that the best way to get rid of angry feelings is to learn to judge the other person favorably. Let me read to you a little story which shows the results of one mother's efforts to teach her small child to judge his little friends favorably. Previous to the incident which she describes, she had on several occasions tried to ease her child's unhappy feelings toward some of his aggressive nursery classmates by suggesting different ways in which he could judge their actions favorably. "I picked my 3.5-year-old up from his nursery the other day, and he looked quite sad. When I asked him if anything was wrong, he told me that one of his little friends had hit him a few times that morning. I empathized with him on his having a hard day, saying, 'Oh dear, It must have been very hard for you to enjoy Gun today if Tali kept hitting you and taking things away from you. He looked up at me and smiled. Then he said, "You know what, Mommy? Maybe Tali just had a hard day today." Okay, a few words on advice. First, try to offer advice sparingly. As well-meaning as our advice may be, children want and need a chance to learn from their own experience. Too much interference with their affairs can lead ultimately to resentment and a general resistance to all advice. When we wisely reserve our advice for when it's really needed, it's far more likely to be accepted. If your advice is rejected, don't argue. For example, your daughter of 7 has received some money for her birthday from her grandparents, and she wants to spend it all on junk food. You've explained that it isn't good for her health, but she wants to spend it her way. Any further efforts to convince her are unlikely to succeed. The best you can do is to tell her, "All right, honey, if that's what you want to do." Don't warn her, "Okay, you'll see. You'll get a stomachache, and then you'll be sorry you didn't listen to me." Also, don't tell her in disgust, "Okay, do whatever you want." You may succeed in making her feel guilty, but she's still not going to listen. Keep in mind that even though children may reject our advice at first, they will frequently reconsider it later when they've had time to think things over. As a matter of fact, we can sometimes end a heated discussion by just saying, "Okay, why don't you think about it a little?" All right, we've talked about how empathy can help us to develop a more understanding relationship with our children, mentioning certain cautions that must nevertheless be taken. Let me remind you once again that for those of us who have not been accustomed to being empathetic, it is not an easy thing to learn. We have to keep reminding ourselves of it, and then just practice, practice, and practice, as we have to do in order to learn any new skill.
Thank you for listening to Series 1 of Effective Jewish Parenting by Miriam Levy. Series 2 deals with how to discipline, helpfulness, praise and encouragement, morning and bedtime routines, orderliness, and crying. The Eshet Torah Audio Center produces and distributes fine cassette tapes on Torah subjects. For our free catalog of more than 1,200 Torah tapes, please write to Eshet Torah Audio Center, P.O. Box 14149, Old City, Jerusalem, Israel.